it's not just a question of, well, we don't have anything, we need to have lesbian writers, we need lesbian novels, lesbian poetry, etc., and just accept anything. That's hardly the criteria that male writers have been accepted on.
Certainly.
And I think that, you know, it's a grave mistake and lessens the force of the movement itself.
Exactly. Well, I agree with you entirely. Sartin and Rule are two names that jumped out, and I think absolutely illustrate your point, because both of them are profiting from the lesbian movement without ever really taking a radical lesbian stance themselves, or not just politically. I would give them that, but that they do not let their politics, if they have any, affect their work. Change that work in any way.
I would like to go back to that, but one thing that I feel, especially with Jane Rule's work, is that it's very, you know, it's sprawling is the only way I can think of describing it, and it has like a drugstore cheapness about it that is a carryover from things like Well of Loneliness and all those novels from the 50s, you know, that came out only in paperback.
And Bannon, Bebo Brinker.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember finding that book when I was babysitting for someone, you know, and devouring it because there was nothing else. But when you have a choice of, you know, the Well of Loneliness or nothing, you know, it's really...
The well.
It's a choice of not much. And I, for one, would like to see good lesbian novels, but I don't think there are a lot around.
Well, I think, for instance, I guess I'm biased because it is my publisher now, but I think that, for instance, Daughters, Inc., who publishes both lesbian and heterosexual women's literature, but if they have feminist consciousness in it, is my best hope to get to what you're talking about. And when I was reviewing Jane Rule's latest book, Lesbian Images, for Ms. Magazine recently, and I found myself saying that her dismissal, her summary dismissal of books from the Daughters Press, very enraging because, and again, that quote from Stein quoting Picasso leapt to my mind, that those who come first don't make it pretty. They're struggling, they're experimenting, they're trying new modes and new forms, and those who come later can make it pretty. And it seems to me that that's what, for instance, June Arnold has done in entirely original works such as Cook and the Carpenter, Sister Jen. These are not polished up and neat, and they don't make you feel good, but
well, there's, you know,
the outline of what
it's the sort of, I would like to see lesbian fiction, you know, acquire the taste and the background of someone's work like Doris Lessing, who writes a very good feminist line. You know, you can't say that she writes any kind of lesbian fiction, but it's possible for work to be good, and, you know, it's immaterial whether it's pretty or not. It's, you know, that The Well of Loneliness was not pretty, and it was not good either.
Right.
You know, you know, it doesn't give you much of a choice. It really doesn't. As what were we talking about before? Politics and art. That is something that I really am interested in your views on. If you feel that it's really necessary to have your art fused with your politics.
I think it is crucial, again, especially to achieve the type of writing you're talking about. In the same way that patriarchal politics are so incredibly fused with writers like James Joyce, who are considered great artists, or James Dickey, who in certain quarters is considered a great artist, that part of building the literature we hope for, that is resonant with our culture and with our learning and with our background and with the details of the world that we need, that we must have a decision-making politics about what we choose to write about, and which even unconsciously can direct what we choose to say and how we detail it. I don't mean, for instance, that we interrupt a scene in between the sheets with a political announcement. We pause in this act to bring you a political announcement.
What do you feel that you have accomplished in your work, and how do you feel about people like, well, the first person that comes to mind, I guess, is Jill Johnston, who is so politically oriented, or even Rita Mae Brown, who is pretty much politically oriented?
Yeah, she would think so. Well, that's three questions.
Okay.
Which one's first? What do I feel like I've accomplished in my own writing? Is that it? I don't know. I don't contemplate it very much after I finished writing it. My work is very difficult, I think, because difficult, say, compared to Ruby for a Triangle Lover, is very difficult to read because it's very dense, and it's very... It was, at least for me, a very courageous attempt to break down the linear pattern of the standard hetero-patriarchal novel form, and to try to make it, not only in content, but in style and tone and flavor, what I had noticed in my own head as a lesbian and what I'd noticed in living with lesbians, to try to make it, well, as Mr. Elliott would say, the style be the content, and the content be the style. I don't think it's an enormous success, but it, you know, I hope I've got maybe 20 good more years to bring it off.
Well, it seems to me to be similar to the things that Virginia Woolf was trying to do when she was writing, particularly her novels in the decade of the 20s.
Yeah.
Very oriented towards what is actually happening, you know, reality-oriented, I suppose, is a way of looking at it.
Well, Woolf felt very, despite these recent books that have come out on her, I think she felt incredibly alien and lived a lot in what she would have liked things to be or what went on in her head, and I think that there may be that similarity. You can't be a lesbian in this culture without feeling somewhat alienated, no matter how hard you try. So, Jill's writing is... I call it passion politics. She's, I think, a very gifted lyricist, and I think her work was crucial at one time, and it may still be, but we haven't heard from her in quite a while.
Sure.
And Rita Mae is charming and funny, and I think her greatest value frequently comes in as being the first book that some lesbians are able to read and get through, and and I love Ruby Fruit Jungle in a particular way because whether Rita knew it or not, I think she was rewriting the old Horatio Alger tales of how I'm a poor downtrodden dyke, but I can pick myself up and overcome all evil and odds and get the prettiest girl to go home with me, and I'll succeed. And it's necessary. All these things are necessary. And I forgot the... straight women.
I'm glad you remembered, because I got completely off the track.
Well, I assume you mean straight feminist.
Yes, I should clarify that. For example, March Piercy, someone, you know, who writes a very feminist-oriented mind, but is not lesbian, despite small changes.
Yeah. Well, quite frankly, it tends to bore me, although I see its virtues a lot. It goes back to what I was trying to articulate about social realism. One thing that struck me, and I can talk about Piercy in terms of some other writers, is that feminist straight writers, novelists, and straight novelists who have been affected by feminism, whether they have chosen to become feminist or not, are writing longer and longer and longer books. They're massive, they're becoming massive, and they are filled with incredible details. It's like wandering around the a very rich archaeological dig and picking up shards and old bottles, and this is what they wore in 1920 or 1221, and this is what they ate and drank, and this is what their funeral customs were and their wedding customs. And even more than, I was thinking of Margaret Drabble's latest novel, The Realms of Gold, which fits all this description. And I read it with a sense of increasing discomfort, and finally I got enraged because she has taken the most superficial analysis of feminism and pulled off or ripped off a novel that has a woman who does not ever fail. She is,
which is not possible.
She succeeds as a mother, as a wife, as a lover, as an archaeologist, as a teacher, as everything. And it's a justification, I think, for continued heterosexuality. Many of those books are. And of course, I don't approve of that.
Do you feel that it's possible for lesbians to live without men completely?
Well, certainly not now. I mean, I rely on men to give me a paycheck at the university. I mean, if that's what you mean. And to ride a subway train and that sort of thing.
There are people who believe that lesbian separatism is an answer, that it completely obviates the need for men in your life. Do you feel that that's real, or that's just something that people use as an excuse?
Well, I think it's more of an example of how Americans think than anything else. Lesbian separatism is, I think, something, it's not an either-or situation. I think this is how we tend to think. We've been trained to think. You're either this or that, you've got to do this or that. It wipes out choices, and it wipes out potentials, and it wipes out discovery. I think, though, that lesbian separatism, therefore, is something that you can go in and out of. That it shouldn't be set up as a sort of monolithic, eternal state.
You gotta stay in it, or
yeah,
you can never come back again.
Right. Because it's also in the world we live in, unless, of course, well, not even unless, of course, in the world we live in, it's not possible. I can wake up in the morning and be so enraged or be so possessed by a particular idea that I go to work feeling and thinking like a lesbian separatist. But again, when I have to look at the fact that I teach in an institution owned and run by men. My money that I support myself comes from those men. The ferry boat I take to Staten Island is run by men, the subway train, the food I buy, the food I eat, etc. I don't think it's solved by saying I'm going to go off on a mountaintop and or in the country and live with other lesbians, because again you have to rely somewhat.
Well, does that mean that that you believe in working within the system? I don't want to catch all.
Well, I don't know whether I believe in it or not. I have to.
Do you think it's possible to work within the system towards, I guess, towards a realization of lesbian worth is probably the best way of saying it, because I don't think we've hit that yet.
Yeah, it's possible. I think if your politics are good and you know who you are and what you're about, you can work within the system up to a certain point. I mean, I could pick out very dramatic instances of what that point is. But, for instance, working within the system, for instance, would be going before a grand jury and squealing on some lesbian, you know, who's done such and such. You know, that's a dramatic point. But I think most lesbians who are probably, as a group, the most economically underprivileged of all, because we are always being threatened with loss of our jobs and our livelihood or being cut off, that it's not a question of whether we want to or not, it's simply that we have to, but that we try to choose work that is as potentially useful to and helpful to as many women as possible.
Where do you feel that children fit into lesbian culture? And where do they fit into an educational perspective?
I think it's impossible to be a mother in this culture. Forget lesbian culture. Things are made so difficult.
Adrienne Rich really goes into that in her book, which is excellent as far as the idea of the institution of motherhood and what society has made that into.
Mm-hmm.
How does your daughter deal with your being a lesbian, or doesn't she?
As soon as she could understand what I was talking about, I talked to her about it, and I think, since birth, she has lived in a lesbian home, so it would be hard to talk about how she deals with it or doesn't deal with it or whatever. To her, it's natural. I don't know, she's had some trouble outside, especially as I became more and more public and whatever, but her responses to that trouble has been to fight back. And I think it's done nothing but good for her. It's made her tough and it's made her strong, and she knows how to take care of herself. And she has at least one crucial advantage I didn't have growing up, and that's that she knows how to take care of herself, and she knows what the realities of heterosexuality are in terms of a lesbian home rather than the reverse of that.
So nothing's an unknown to her, really.
No.
Seeing things from all perspectives.
Yeah.
How do you feel in your job and as a writer, being an out lesbian?
Well, I could get very anecdotal about that. I came out when I was interviewing for my job at the City University of New York to be director of Women's Studies program at Richmond College in Staten Island, and I'd simply decided that I could not live that. I couldn't live closeted on the job, even to a small extent, anymore, because it was getting in the way with my thinking. It was getting in the way of my teaching and the whole shebang. And I had interesting reactions to it: fear and trembling from many women, who I noticed sometimes walked out of the bathroom as I walked in, even though they hadn't used it yet. Shades of Edward the Dyke.
Right, exactly.
The reactions of some of the men, one in particular I recall coming into my office every single day with no business, nothing really, no excuse, and telling me stories about lesbians.
Shades of the Children's Hour.
Right. And my favorite story about him is I watched the blue movie flicker through his brain. He finally said, you know, it's really funny, you know, every time my wife and I go to a party, there's always some lesbian there trying to pick her up. And I did a double take and I said, well, Tom, the only thing I can say is that this is, I hate to bring this up and I hate to say it because it's probably going to make a considerable difference in your marriage, but it's common knowledge that lesbians only are attracted to other lesbians. And he went away and I never saw him again. And that stopped that.
Oh, that's marvelous. That really is. That is a marvelous answer.
I offer it for anyone's use, but other things that have happened, one thing that's been very strange is that everybody thought I was going to get fired, and especially the closet dykes there. And it was just the reverse. Coming out had marvelous psychologically strengthening resonances in my life. I was able to work more. I felt freer. I've probably accomplished more than most of the women there with all their household help and et cetera and their money. And so that, in a way, very literal way, keeps me working. I mean, they can't really fire you if you've published more than everybody else. But the other effects were that in an odd way, I had a leg up on a lot of the women, the straight women in the school, because the men, for all the wrong reasons, respected me instead of them. Since I wasn't a sexual possibility, then they would talk to me like one of the boys. Now that is screwed up from beginning to end, but still, it was to my, it always has been to my advantage.
It seems to me that once you come out, there's nothing that people can hold against you. I think one of the biggest fears for any gay person is my parents are going to find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and after your parents know, I don't think it really matters who else knows. And it seems to me that in any kind of job situation, if they know ahead of time, what can they can't hold it over you. I mean, they can't say, you know, we didn't know this.
I think the only time it they can sort of get at you is, unless you're at the top of the power heap, they can get you in secret votes and secret meetings. Because the university situation, which is what I know best, very, very few women have positions of power, not to mention lesbians. And the boys get together at the top administrative levels, and although they will not, they're too hip to admit why they're firing you.
Mm-hmm.
They get you on a technicality, and they have a vote, and bang, you're out the door.
Do you have tenure at the university?
No.
When will you be up for it?
This spring.
Do you think you'll get it?
I'm about 90% certain that I will, because I don't see that they have just cause for doing otherwise. Since I've done all the things that you're supposed to do,
right.
Teach, publish, etc.
Right.
And but in my case, I think there are problems because, as you know, the city university is in terrible trouble because New York City is in terrible trouble, and when they start cutting back the money, they start cutting back.
The faculty
first.
Are you planning on doing a book on Paris in the 20s?
Well, I've been sort of collecting pieces of paper and note cards and so forth all along, but I realized that the task had been pretty much taken out of my hands, and I'm very grateful for it to be taken out of my hands by a woman
at the university, who's finishing her dissertation now at the University of Michigan, a woman named Gail Rubin, who wrote the introduction to A Woman Appeared to Me. And Gail's had the considerable advantage of lots of trips to Paris and interviews with the survivors of that era.
Such as Juno Barnes?
No one gets to Juno Barnes as far as I know. I think she has maybe two or three people she speaks to, and she's very, very private, very sequestered. I think Gail talked to an old servant of Natalie Clifford Barney's, and was able to run off with some of the most marvelous photographs of Renee Vivian and Natalie Barney and all the gang.
Do you think that there's any possibility of sorting out of the past, almost, you know, in archaeological context, a lesbian culture, you know, that has existed since, I suppose, Sappho was the best person to use as, you know, a starting mm-hmm. place. Do you think it's possible to do that?
Well, I think perhaps the artifacts, or the, speaking archaeologically, perhaps the artifacts, many of the artifacts of that culture, if there ever was one, Amazonian or matriarchal or whatever, are here. It's just a matter of interpretation, of interpreting those things and those bits and pieces of literature that we're left with. One of the ways I decided to open up to begin passages in Lover was by telling a little saint story, a story of the female saints in the from the Catholic hagiography. And I, having been raised in parochial schools, this had been drummed into me, but something hit me one day that I didn't have to look for evidences of lesbians in the sweet by and by, that the lesbians were there already. So I went off and got a copy of The Lives of the Saints, and I began reading, and by God, every single woman that I read about in The Lives of the Saints, Saint Teresa, Saint Catherine, Saint Barbara, and so forth and so on, all got to be saints primarily because they resisted heterosexual intercourse with men. And so, turned around through this interpretation, what we've got there are the lives of the lesbians.
True.
Teresa goes into a convent basically because she wants to be an intellectual. She wants to escape men and marriage and childbirth.
And also, the convent was the only alternative for
exactly.
women who wanted education.
Right.
It's also interesting that the voices that she heard were women.
Sure.
Joan of Arc is an example of a woman who was primarily roasted because she refused to cater to male privilege.
Right. She was roasted also because she wore the wrong clothes, and she was independent, and she looked good on a horse, I guess.
You've got Maria Goretti in this century, you know, the classic example that they always throw up to you in Catholic school of a woman who died for her purity, you know, and it always struck me that she died because she just didn't want some man to touch her.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that that's, you know, the best interpretation of it. And the Church has used lesbians for their own purposes, you know,
mm-hmm.
to promote the ideal of virginity, when it, in fact, you know, it probably is women who are involved with other women, and
sure.
she's not with men.
Or at least rejecting men and all their institutions. Yeah, I simply loved the saints after I discovered that and realized that. Oh, and I love the miracles that accompany their salvation. From men, the little maiden is walking down the road, and out jumps a big rapist out of the bushes, and her eyes roll up to heaven and prays, and she prays for salvation, and suddenly her body from head to toe grows a huge gorilla-like coat of hair, and our neighborhood rapist runs screaming because she's no longer cute and attractive.
It's really a different perspective from Paul's perspective of what women were. You know,
yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Well, I certainly want to thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it looks like we've just about run out of time. That's it for the Women's Consciousness Raising Hour. Have a nice day.